At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Elbridge Colby, the author of the new book, The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. We turn to Beijing's point of view, the theoretical coalition arranged by the United States and its allies, naming Australia, India. There are pieces of this coalition extant right now, the Quad, India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. The new AUKUS, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, ANZUS, the American, New Zealand, and Australia, and others, a bilateral defensive arrangement with Japan, and other allies, Japan with an alliance in some fashion with Vietnam. All of these things, however, the larger coalition, it faces Beijing. Beijing has to assume all of these things are part of the anti-hegemonic, anti-Beijing power and ambition. So we look at Beijing's best strategy. Hide and bide is a possibility, was a possibility. What does that mean, Bridge? And has Beijing quit that or is it continuing?
Hide and bide was the line that Deng Xiaoping, the admonition he gave to Chinese leaders and so forth, I think in the 1970s. And it was hide your capabilities and bide your time. So basically, you know, the idea being let's grow, let's get rich, and then we'll be powerful. And then everyone will have to respect us, but keep a low profile for as long as possible. In a sense, this is kind of what the United States did in the 19th century with a few exceptions. And you know, the end result, if you're successful, is people suddenly, you know, realize, oh my gosh, this is a dominant power. We just have to deal with it. Beijing abandoned it more or less starting probably about 10 years ago. Certainly with Xi Jinping's accession to power, it's become much more assertive, much more aggressive and belligerent. And the thing about that is that I don't think China can go back. You know, once people have seen that China's going to behave this way, once it's so strong, they're not going to be able to persuade people that they'll go back to this sort of quiescent approach, because the soothing logic, the soothing appeal that you know you forward under hide and bide is, oh, we're getting richer, but it's win-win. We're all going to get rich. We're going to become like you. We're going to accept all your rules and everything. And that's been shown to be false.
All right. Hide and bide is momentarily set aside, though Belt and Road is a version of hide and bide. Would you agree? The economic authority masking the reach for power.
It can fit under, but I mean, Belt and Road has some pretty strong political conditions attached often, and I don't think they're very subtle. The Beijing is very subtle about it. Hide and bide would have been more inclined towards really playing by the legacy structures and rules that had emerged, quote unquote rules that had emerged in the international system. So I don't think they can go back to hide and bide. I don't think anybody would be fooled.
You make the very clear case that Beijing is following now and will in the future a focused and sequential plan towards the coalition. What does that mean?
Sure. So, I mean, you've described very eloquently, John, you know, what the anti-hegemonic coalition is all about. It's basically a classic balancing coalition. Its exact form is ambiguous and inchoate and may never be formally and maybe overlapping, maybe confused. That's not the point. Essentially, the anti-hegemonic coalition is just a description for states that are meaningfully acting in some way together to check China's dominance of the region. U.S. alliances can exist within that. Different kinds of relationships like Vietnam or India can exist within that. But, you know, that's basically happening largely because of China's behavior. Now, China could, if China's serious about pursuing its goals of regional dominance, which I think it is, it's not going to take that sitting down, right? Because if you allow that coalition to come together and be effective, China's goals will be blunted. So China has a couple choices. It can't go back to hide and bide. It could try to precipitate a very large conflict, a challenge to the entire coalition in the way that, say, like Hitler did, But that, of course, is at a minimum extremely costly and risky, and almost, in my view, would almost certainly fail at this stage, at least. So China's smart strategy is a little bit more along the lines of how Bismarck, for instance, operated in the 1860s, 1870s, which is, look, the anti-hegemonic coalition is held together ultimately by, in a significant degree at least, by the confidence in the United States. And that's because China is so powerful that it's much more powerful than any state in Asia, well, any state in the world other than the United States. So any state that's isolated in front of China's ire will be fried. And no state wants to be in that situation. They will be then, they will be heavily inclined towards cutting a deal with China. So the key then is to essentially undermine that confidence in the U.S. And the way I think they want to do that is this focused and sequential strategy, which is essentially lasering in on more vulnerable, but, you know, material parts of the anti-hegemonic coalition, demonstrating its hollowness. And then they don't have to fight a huge war because people will see that it's a hollow shell and it'll fall apart and Beijing will essentially be regionally predominant. So I say sequential. I'm not sure Beijing would have to do this many times in order to, because of how sensitive countries' perceptions are. I mean, Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines has already made open what many are thinking, which is that they don't trust the United States as strong and resolute enough to help stand up against China. So if China can do that a couple of times, they may be able to get their way to a regionally ascendant position. I think that's their best strategy, and it does seem to be consistent with at least certainly the military they're building, in some ways their political behavior.
It is literally ironic that Bridge builds his book around Carl von Clausewitz's quotes from On War, and that von Clausewitz lived in a period of coalition building against one hegemon aggressor. That would have been Napoleon Bonaparte. And so all the recommendations by Clausewitz can fit what we're now talking about. And one of them, if I understand correctly, is the way Napoleon approached that coalition, the way China can approach the coalition, is to pick on one particular target and demonstrate its power, overwhelming power, and see if the coalition holds together in response. You have two possibilities here, Bridge. You target a U.S. ally, or you target someone who is not a coalition member. That would be target Taiwan, a U.S. ally, ambiguously, or Manila, a U.S. ally, clearly, or Japan, or target someone outside of that reach, which would be Vietnam. Would they both work in the same fashion?
It's a bit counterintuitive, but I think for Beijing, targeting somebody linked to the United States is better. The problem with targeting somebody who's not is that you actually could end up strengthening perceptions or confidence in the U.S. And this is actually the best thing that ever happened in NATO after the Cold War is Russia's intervention into Crimea, or invasion of Crimea and its intervention to Ukraine, because it indicated that NATO actually was intimidating to Moscow, right? So if Beijing is trying to get at the core of this anti-hegemonic coalition, which is the perception, the confidence in the United States, then it has to go with somebody linked to the United States, but not Japan. Japan's too strong. Beijing's claim is too limited. It's too closely tied to the United States. It's better for Beijing to go after somebody maybe like the Philippines, where yes, we have a longstanding alliance, but we haven't had forces there since 1992 or so. Or even better, Taiwan, which, yes, it's not an ally, but everybody in the region believes that it's a canary in the coal mine for U.S. credibility. And China has relatively speaking, a much better claim on Taiwan than it does on, say, you know, Luzon or something like that. So I think China's best strategy is to go after, and I think you make a good point. I think I'm not an expert on Napoleonic history, but, you know, for instance, the example of the Prussians, I think in 1807, you know, when Napoleon really made an example, and it reverberated in Moscow and Vienna and so forth. And I mean, Napoleon was overly aggressive at the end of the day, obviously, but he knew how to short circuit a coalition.
We go to now what is to be done. Now that you've identified a target, Taiwan, Taipei, and I mention, just because I'm reading a new book about how Stalin behaved before he became an ally of the United States, he and Molotov always made the argument that they were only taking back land that was the Russian Empire and a land that is dominated by Russian speakers. That would be one of the explanations that Beijing could offer in the presumption that they move on Taiwan. It is our 10th province. They already use that language, so it's useful. However, Beijing can choose the punishment tool. What is the punishment tool? How does it work?
Sure. I mean, there are basically two ways to try to subordinate a country when it doesn't really want to do something. One is by the imposition of costs, punishment. Think, I'm going to bomb you into submission. I'm going to blockade you. I'm going to essentially inflict, you know, think of taking down, a, you know, your electric grid with a cyber attack. That's punishment. The alternative is the direct application of force, essentially invasion. And in the book, I've concluded that, you know, based on history, and I think conceptually as well, deductively as well, that invasion is generally by far the more reliable and effective way of getting somebody to do something that they don't want. And I think history bears that out. And actually, often when we do see punishment campaigns being undertaken, it's because of lack of an option. So we mentioned Napoleon. Napoleon planned to invade Great Britain, but he was traded in that. And then he applied the continental system, as an attempt to blockade the British. Likewise, Hitler wanted, you know, was thinking about an invasion force, and the Blitz was actually only followed the Germans' conclusion that, that they weren't going to be able to muster an invasion force, given their other aspirations. So I think that's, you know, a lot of people focus on punishment. They say, oh, they could blockade, they could take down someone's cyber network. The problem the Chinese face here when you think about this focus and sequential strategy is if they're going to get their way to regional predominance, they really have to get countries in the region to give up what I call or think of as core goods. You know, autonomy, political independence, freedom. I mean, let's be honest, right? Because basically what they're seeking is the ability to dictate central decisions for other countries, other peoples. You know, security, but also economic, their political systems ultimately. Maybe not directly on day one, but if, you know, if you're going to fall under the Chinese thumb, they may not force you to change your system of government on, you know, day two, but you don't know 3 or 5 or 10 years hence if they're going to get more aggressive. I mean, countries, when they get more powerful, they get aggressive. I actually think the United States is a good example of this. During the Cold War, we tended to be relatively moderate in the demands we put on our allies and other countries. After the Cold War, when we became really, really powerful, our aspirations became and our ambitions became much, much more forward-leaning. I mean, look at how we treated, say, Indonesia or Pakistan would be another example, countries that we had to deal with in the Cold War, and we kind of moderated our pressure. But in the wake of the Cold War, for good or ill, whether you think it was good or ill, we became much more expensive. So I think that's why punishment is probably, at the end of the day, China's not going to go there.
Turn to two other possibilities. Both fit together. One is conquest. One is overwhelming, fait accompli conquest. The strategy of denial is the book, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. Albridge Colby is the author. This is CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBSI on the World with John Batchelor.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/IHEART for 40% off. Terms apply.